to the Tuesday, February 19th meeting of the House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules. And members, you will see on your agenda that we have two items that were posted for 5:15. That's House Bill 3602 and 3634, and we're going to start with those two. Then we have two items that were carried over that we didn't finish this morning. And we will, I intend to have House Bill 3603 be the last bill on our agenda for this evening. So you'll see out in front of you a lot of material, and you'll probably have time to file it away as we go through the evening. We will not be taking any more public testimony on House Bill 3603, but we did get a lot of requests from people who wanted to have additional input, so that's why you have a stack, big stack, of written testimony, so have that ready. So let's get started. And I will open a work session on House Bill 3602. Marjorie, could you please tell us about this bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3602 modifies the deadline for the Secretary of State to file information with the clerks regarding offices, candidates, and measures for the November general election. However, you have the Dash 1 amendment, which requires all of the information regarding president and vice president to be filed with the county clerks no later than 55 days before the election, and then all other information about candidates and measures would be provided to the clerks by the 61-day deadline.
Thank you, Marjorie. And members, you'll remember this bill because we held a hearing on it, I believe, on the 15th. So it's a clarification and a necessary statutory change brought about because the timing of a national convention for the Republicans comes too late for the candidate nominated for president to be able to get on the ballot here in Oregon. The Dash 1 amendment that Marjorie mentioned is a clarification that was requested by the county clerks to clarify that this extension only applies to candidates for president and vice president so that everything else on the ballot would follow its normal deadlines. I think it's pretty straightforward. Are there any questions? Yes, Representative Berger.
If I understand, 7 through 11 of the printed bill then go away and just that the statement containing information regarding candidates for the office of President and Vice President of the United States, and this is what the county clerks wanted.
That's okay. Exactly right.
Okay, thank you.
So, any further questions? Okay, then we are in a work session.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I would like to move approval of the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3602.
Representative Berger has moved the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3602. Is there any discussion? Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Berger.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3601 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Berger has moved House Bill 3602.
Did I say
3206? That's amazing. The amendment.
That's a good one.
The one you were talking about. Okay, so Representative Berger has moved House Bill 3602 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, it is so ordered.
Well, can I carry it, Madam Chair? No, Steve, I'm teasing.
Absolutely. The chair will carry this bill. Thank you. And I will close the work session on House Bill 3602. And I will open a public hearing and work session on House Bill 3634.
Marjorie. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3634 directs the Secretary of State to number measures to be voted on in the state in a certain order. It declares an emergency, and you have the Dash 1 amendment that is not reflected in the staff measure summary, which clearly states that they'll be filed in order. They'll be numbered in the order that they're filed, not in the order that they're certified.
Okay, does everybody have the Dash 1 amendment in front of them? I know a lot of paper was put out in front of you.
It's attached to the staff measure summary.
So it's stapled to the back of your staff measure summary.
Mm-hmm.
And members, this is a new bill that we introduced the other day, so although we discussed some of the concepts in it, we have not actually had a hearing on it. I'll just talk a little bit about the need for this bill. This is really a clarification of preparation of the ballot for the next election. Normally, things appear on the ballot in the order that they are laid out in this bill, and that is what voters are used to seeing. It turned out that in discussions with the Secretary of State, the language of the statute does not give clear enough direction to the Secretary of State to say that measures should appear in the order that they're specified here, which is namely constitutional amendments that have been referred, followed by other referrals that are non-statutory, followed by initiatives and referendums. And with this amendment, which we haven't adopted yet, the initiative and referendum petitions would then appear on the ballot in the order that they are turned in other words, not the order that they're originally filed, because a lot of them don't go forward, but once the signatures are submitted for verification, they would appear in the order in which they were submitted. So that's basically what the bill does. We do have people in the room that can answer any technical questions, and it's a bill that's needed to clarify in order to be able to print the ballot. So are there any questions about that? Okay, then I guess this is crystal clear.
Madam Chair.
Yes,
Ms. Trevor. I will go on the record here. I think that this is something that the Secretary of State seems to feel the need of, that he's always done sort of by he or she, by their own prerogative, and I think it is an oddity that we have some things coming in ahead of legislative referrals, and I'm discomforted and see this as sort of a way of putting the legislature ahead of a lot of signature verifications or signatures that have come in on initiatives ahead of us, and so it isn't really in order. It's in order that some folks clearly want it to be in this order. I don't really agree with that, and probably will reject this vote. No.
Thank you for your comment.
Poorly expressed, and I'm sorry.
Well, it's the end of a long day.
It is the end of a long day.
Thank you, Representative Berger. Representative Hunt.
I just consider it the start of a long evening. That's a better way to look at it. Since Representative Berger still just said probably, I will try to make the case one more time. Since
okay. You said you still
probably no. I really view this actually very similar to the bill we just passed related to adding a to making sure that we have presidential nominees from both political parties on the fall ballot. That's clearly the historical precedent. That's the way we've always done it before. Because of the oddities of this year and when one party's convention happens to fall, we need a statutory fix in order to make sure that historical precedent is followed. I actually think this is the exact same thing. Because of the oddity of having some initiatives kind of interspliced between legislative referrals, the only way to maintain the historic precedent of legislative referrals first, followed by initiative petitions and referenda, is to do this fix. And I actually think having legislative referrals, not only is that the historical precedent the way we've done it, I think it also just makes tremendous sense. If we look at the process that legislative referrals go through in terms of, you know, a public process, committee hearings, amendments, consideration in committees on the floor, in another committee, on another floor, the opportunity for the public and representatives of the public to really engage versus many initiatives which can often just be written on the back of a napkin and then go out for gathering. There's no public amendment, no public hearing, no public analysis, no public vote by the representatives of the people. I just think they are two different issues, and I think for the public, they don't have to agree with the conclusions we come to, but they're clearly two completely different processes, and I think it makes sense for the public to know these are the legislative referrals that have gone through that careful process. The legislature may have got it right or wrong, and then these are the initiatives that have come by signature, and the person who wrote it may have gotten it right or wrong. I just think they are two different animals, and making that clear to voters in terms of the order, not only honors that historic precedent, but I think make sense in terms of their giving them a chance to make good judgments, up or down.
Yes, Representative Thatcher.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm going to be real eloquent too, but I think it's a bunch of baloney that the Secretary of State won't possibly know how to print the ballots if they don't have the statute. I just think it's, we're dealing with certain very hot political topics, and we want to make sure that those get listed first rather than last, and I think that is what we're doing here. I will be voting no if you haven't figured that out yet.
Let me guess.
Thank you, Representative Thatcher, for your comment.
I would just say, speaking for myself, that I was also surprised that this issue wasn't clear-cut, because having voted for many years, more years than unfortunately a lot of other people in the room, I had always believed that this was the order in which measures appeared, and I think if you look back historically, you will find that that is the case, that legislative referrals have been at the top of the ballot. I think that it's really a clarification. It is certainly not, speaking for myself and other members of this committee, perhaps not for all the members of this committee, there's certainly no intention to try to do anything to manipulate the process. In fact, as somebody who is a deep believer in the initiative process, who has served as a chief petitioner more than once, I would never put my name or my vote to any bill that did that. So I feel quite strongly that it is a needed clarification, and that really is all it is. So, further discussion. We are in a work session, and we do have a -1 amendment. Representative Hunt.
Madam Chair, I move the -1 amendment to House Bill 3634.
Representative Hunt has moved the -1 amendment to House Bill 3634. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Is there objection? Seeing none, amendment is adopted. Representative Hunt.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3634 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Hunt has moved House Bill 3634 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, will you please call the roll?
Representative Esquivel?
No.
Representative
White? Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
No.
Vice Chair Berger?
No.
Vice Chair Buckland?
Aye.
Chair Rosenbaum?
Aye. Motion carries, and the chair will carry this bill. And let's stand at ease for just a moment. To order, and I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3615. And I will talk about this.
We appreciate that, Madam Chair.
There is a -1 amendment to House Bill 3615, which replaces the bill. And as you saw when this was posted on the agenda, this bill is, and this amendment is, the ballot title for a property crimes referral. That property crimes measure, the primary part of it is in Senate Bill 1087. Senate Bill 1087 just passed next door from the Ways and Means Committee, and one member of our committee, Representative Shields, who's on Ways and Means, was there, so he can attest that that is true. So now what you have before you in the -1 amendment is a ballot title that describes that measure as a referral. So I will not attempt to explain it myself, but I will call Senator Floyd Prezansky, who has joined us to the witness table, to tell us about it. And looks like perhaps somebody from Legislative Council is with him.
You always want to have the legal, certified, smart people with you for these type of questions and inquiries. Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Floyd Prezansky, State Senator, District 4. And House Bill 3615-1 is the amendment that is being proposed for your review and hopefully approval as the ballot title that would accompany what has just passed out of the Ways and Means unanimously, Senate Bill 1087. Specifically, what this ballot title will do is actually put us on record as the legislature as to describing what the Senate Bill 1087 includes. You will see that there are certain provisions that we have placed in here, including that we can exceed the word limit to make certain that we have the ability to have clarity in the caption, the yes vote, and also the summary. The no vote, I believe, is within the allotted number of words that are normally there. The other part that I want to make certain that everyone understands is that this approval of this measure will not prohibit anyone who chooses to challenge the ballot title to be able to go to through the court process to challenge it. If you historically, if you remember last session, we did have a ballot title that had to be taken care of and put out for the vote on Measure 49. Because of the lateness in time on that measure, passing in the late part of June, just toward the end of the session, it was determined that we would not have enough time to adequately have it aired through that process, and we actually prohibited any challenge for the ballot title the legislature passed during that session for that measure. This does not do that. This is just basically putting us on record as to what we believe the measure that they will be voting on, what it contains, and precisely allows us to choose the words that are used and still provide and preserve the right of anyone who wants to challenge the ballot title to be able to do so, with the exception of the word limit. Now, I do want to put let me just leave it there, and I think it's pretty straightforward as to what it provides for. If there are questions regarding any part of the ballot title or historical perspective, I guess one thing I could give to you is from a historical perspective, in 1999, this legislature had the duty of referring to the voters eight different victim rights bills because they had all been bundled into one. I believe it was Measure 40, and the court said that those should have been divided into individual components, and so at that time I was serving as the vice chair of the House Criminal Judicial Committee under the chair, Kevin Mannix, and Representative Mannix at the time took it upon himself to write each and every ballot title that went and accompanied each of those measures that we referred out from the legislature for the vote of the people. So that's something, a snapshot of where it has occurred previously, and something that seems to be succinct as to in the area of field that we're dealing with, and I just wanted to kind of put that out there for perspective.
Thank you, Senator Przanski, for your testimony. I well remember 1999 because it was my first legislative session, and it was quite the tour de force, I think, with you and Representative at the time Mannix on those measures. So here we are again. Yes, Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On of the dash one, the back page, lines 18 through 23, it talks about it's the comparison. If this measure gets more votes than the other specified measure, fewer votes than the other specified measure. Is that really adequate language, the other specified measure on this ballot to impose minimum sentences for listed crimes? It seems like we'd have to be more specific than that.
Madam Chair, Representative Hunt, that's why I have certified smart legal counsel here as to why that exact terminology has been chosen.
And thank you for that. For the record, my name is Josh Nasby. I'm a deputy with Legislative Council. That's an excellent observation. I think the problem is it's currently, the ballot measure we're referring to is currently given an initiative petition number.
Okay.
Doesn't have a ballot measure number. And so there's two different approaches you could take. This is one you see reflected here. The other approach would be to leave it blank and instruct the Secretary of State to fill in the number. But we believe that that causes delegation issues in terms of giving the Secretary of State the authority to go in and change a law. This is a law that you will have passed. And so we think that's problematic. So this is our best attempt to narrow in on the measure we're referring to.
Follow up. So if Representative Berger and I decided we wanted to introduce a new initiative that also did impose minimum sentences for listed crimes, there's no chance we're going to end up in a scenario where we end up, instead of comparing two measures, where this is construed to compare to a third or a fourth measure on the ballot.
Representative Hunt, Chair Rosenbaum, the provisions of the bill are very specific. The provisions of the bill refer to IP 40, so I don't think legally, in terms of substantive effect, that's a concern.
Thank you.
And Representative Berger, you wanted to get in on that signature gathering effort with Representative Hunt?
You and me, Berger.
No, I wanted to ask Senator Przanski a question if I could.
Please go ahead.
Senator Przanski, I loved your history comment about writing ballot titles. Was consideration given to having this written by the AG's office in the way that ballot titles are written for initiatives?
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, yes, there was consideration. I will tell you, as a sitting senator, as a member of the legislature, as all of us are, I feel that we have a duty to tell the people what we are bringing forward and allowing them to hear it from us in our own spoken or written word. Clearly, in this situation, because of the time frame being in February, there's plenty of time for allowing for a challenge if someone disagrees that we're not being accurate or inaccurate. But I felt, just as I think Representative Mannix felt back in 1999 with Measure 68 through 75, that we, the legislature, had the duty to express what we believe we were putting before them. And I should note to you at that time, word count varied, and the caption was limited to 10 words, where it now is limited to 15. And during that set of amendments, or to say ballot measures, my count, 5 of the 8 went over the designated word count at that time.
Did that answer your question?
Yeah, that does answer my question. I would further comment, if you don't mind, that I think there's also time to go through the secretary's the AG's process, and I appreciate that you chose not to.
Okay. Any other questions for the senator or for legislative council?
Yeah,
yes, Representative Thatcher.
If there was consideration to go to the AG's office, and that was decided against, was there consideration for a varying of the process such that an opponent would have to actually go and hire an attorney and go through a different process than what is in place for referrals and initiatives, which is going through the ballot title process with the AG's office?
Let me take a stab at answering what I think you're asking, because right now, regardless of how the ballot title is written, if anybody wants to challenge the ballot title, unless they are a lawyer, they pretty much would have to get a lawyer to get into court and challenge the ballot title, because those challenges do happen in front of the Supreme Court. And so, it's certainly somebody like me, I guess, could represent myself and try to get up and argue against a ballot title. But generally, it is with the benefit of legal counsel people do that. So maybe I didn't understand.
Well, I understand that. But prior to that, when you're coming up with a ballot title, there's a panel of people for and against, and they come up with words. I thought that's how the process occurs. That my mistake.
I see what you're asking. Go ahead,
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher. That's not how the ballot title part works. If you submitted a proposal, then it would go through the Attorney General's process of assigning one. Then there's comment that's taken back and forth.
That's right.
There's two points I guess want to make. Number one, it can always be challenged as we're put forward, is that we're not prohibiting anyone from having that opportunity to do that. And the other part was,
I think one thing to point out that our committee staff just pointed out to me is there's also a process called an explanatory statement.
Right, and that's the other part.
And that is, I think, what you were describing, where people are appointed who are supporters, opponents, and neutral. And this proposal doesn't change the explanatory statement process at all. It'll still go through the normal panels as you were describing them. So. Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, that is correct. What they'll do, there'll be 5 people that will be appointed, 2 that are for, 2 that are against, and then the individuals will attempt to select the 5th, and if not, I think it defaults to the Secretary of State to make that decision as to who the fifth. But that will stay in place. There also will be the opportunity for the legislature to put in a piece in support of that will be our opportunity to go in greater detail. And if you... My state representative.
No.
Oh, you look like you're grabbing. And the other part that I think is worth mentioning is within the summary that we have here, we actually have a C, the explanatory statement, for more information.
This would be a good point for me to remind all members of the audience and members of the legislature to pick up their cell phones.
Madam Chair, just a little light humor here. On February 4th, when we started our special session, supplemental session, I had to be in court in Lane County, and my practice is pretty much in the municipal court sections, except when cases that the city prevails on prosecution get appealed. And I heard the deputy come in, and she said, all cell phones off, and someone else had said, all cell phones off. I had to walk outside, and I walked back in, and the next thing I saw, she says, I have someone's cell phone, Your Honor. And it turned out it was a young man who was brought up to the podium with an attorney who introduced him and said, I think he has something to say to the court. He apologized to the court for his phone going off. Then the deputy was told by the judge that she could give it back to him, and as she was handing it, says that would have been $25 if she didn't accept her apology. So we could really be making some money for the education fund or whatever other purpose
that's
you might
great.
Have.
That's great. You're giving us lots of ideas.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry. Were you finished with your answer?
Yeah, I think the explanatory statement part, that's still there. The only thing is what we're doing is we're putting out in front what we believe the ballot measure will contains and how to express it and still allow it to go through the scrutiny of anyone who wants to challenge it.
Great. Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you very much for your explanation. And members, we are in a work session, and we have a Dash 1 amendment. And Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 3615.
Representative Buckley has moved the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 3615. Is there any discussion? Yes, Representative Berger.
Notwithstanding the Senator's wonderful story from the 1999, it would have been my choice to have this go through the AG process, and I'll oppose the bill. I'll vote against the bill.
Thank you for your comment. And Representative Thatcher.
Yes, very well said. And we started hearing this bill at 5:50. It is now 6:03. We've had, in this great deliberative process, less than 15 minutes to even consider it, and I will be voting against it.
Thank you for your comment, and I will just respond, Representative Thatcher, by saying that as soon as I had this amendment available, I did distribute it to the members. So,
I understand.
In part, its timeliness was because the Ways and Means Committee was deliberating on the measure it describes until just really they were still in session when we had to convene this.
Nevertheless, less than 15 minutes.
Okay. Thank you. We take your point. Further discussion on the amendment? On the amendment, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Esquivel?
No.
Representative Hunt?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
No.
Vice Chair Berger?
No.
Vice Chair Buckley?
Aye.
Chair Rosenbaum?
Aye. Motion carries. And the amendment is adopted. And Representative Buckley?
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3615 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Buckley has moved House Bill 3615 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Yes, Representative Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will be supporting this, and I think it's important to also take a look at the big picture of what we're trying to do here. And I think on an issue of this magnitude, it is appropriate to give voters a choice and to leave it up to them to see whether or not they believe this package of increasing sentences for repeat offenders plus drug treatment is the preference of the voters.
Further discussion? Seeing none, on the motion, will the clerk please call the roll?
No.
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
No.
Representative Vice Chair Berger?
No.
Vice Chair Buckley?
Aye.
Chair Rosenbaum?
Aye. Motion carries. And we will ask Representatives McPherson and Olson to carry this on the floor. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 3615. And I will open a work session on House Bill 3603. Members, we are back on House Bill 3603, which we were discussing this morning, although it seems like yesterday morning by now. And we have in front of us a new amendment, and that is the Dash 3 amendment that was distributed to your offices earlier today. Looks like we have a new staff measure summary that I'm sure our capable staff is working on very hard to get it ready. And I also see Representative Holby prepared to talk about it. Marjorie, did you want to tell us anything about it?
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd just like to call your attention that in addition to the Dash 3 amendment in your packet, I do have the fiscal impact statement on the Dash 3.
Where I see that. That is stapled to the back of the staff measure summary along with the amendment. So, and I do see that we also have the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services back with us, prepared to, I assume, answer any technical questions that come up. So, Representative Holby, tell us about this amendment.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum.
Perhaps, Corey, would you like to come up as well, just because I have a feeling there may be technical questions. Sorry to interrupt you, Representative Holby. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee. And I took some input on the Dash 1 amendments, and now I'm presenting before you the House Bill 3603-3 amendments. And just so there's no confusion, the Dash 2 amendments were also requested by the City of Portland, and they realized that they think their issues are already addressed in the bill, so at this point they're not considering those. So I'm here to ask for consideration of the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3603 only. And maybe I could just go through and highlight some of the changes between the Dash 3 and the Dash 1 amendment, since we've already talked about those. The first change from the Dash 1s is on page 4, and it's under the definitions of subprime mortgage. And we added a little bit of authority for the director of DCBS in establishing by rule what a subprime mortgage is.
Section 4?
Oh, excuse me. That's under Section 2. It's page 4, excuse me, if I spoke incorrectly. Section 2, subsection 8. So there is a slight change in that wording, as well. The next change is under Section 3 in the prepayment section, where we have changed the period before the scheduled adjustment of the interest rate from 90 days in the Dash 1 to 60 days before the first scheduled adjustment in this Dash 3 to closer align it with the federal proposals. And then again on the next page under required disclosures under Section 4, we also made a change on line 19 in that subparagraph E in describing the amount of compensation or payment made under the mortgage agreement to a person that originates, negotiates, or brokers the mortgage. So we did narrow that description somewhat. And lastly, the next change from the Dash 1s is in Section 9 of the bill, where we had left the amounts blank for adjusting the bonding amount required. We have put back in the status quo or what's currently in statute on those amounts and are not proposing any changes to those bonding amounts in this bill anymore. So those are essentially the changes that I'm offering up for you. And just to go a little bit further, I had staff hand out a prepayment penalty sheet that shows policies by state and shows what other states have done in this arena, and there's a wide range of differences of what different states have done, and in I believe 31 other states there are either bans or restrictions on prepayment penalties, some on all loans and some just applicable to subprime and high cost loans. And as well, that's the District of Columbia also has a ban on prepayment penalties and a restriction as well. So I just wanted to provide that for the committee. There was some discussion about that. And then on the back side of that, there's a look at a graph that shows where prepayment penalty policy versus loan activity, and not really seeing any difference in loan activity where there are prepayment penalties in existence now. So I just wanted to provide that information for the committee, and certainly I'd be willing to entertain any questions that I can answer.
Okay, thank you, Representative Holby, for that explanation. Are there any questions? Perhaps we'll just let you breathe deeply for a moment, because this is, I know this is substantially similar to what we looked at this morning and had quite a bit of discussion, but it's pretty long.
So this morning.
Let the members. It was just this morning, yes.
Oh.
Yes, I see that we have some questions. Representative Berger.
Representative Holby, there is nothing in this new amendment that changes the language that makes it clear that state chartered banks are under these provisions and federally chartered banks and credit unions are not under these provisions. Mm. There was no change in that language from the previous.
Well, I would defer to Corey Streisinger on that. I believe that this bill only applies to banking institutions and institutions that can be regulated by the state of Oregon and not any of those that are regulated by the federal government.
I think I've answered my own question on page 2. A lender does not include a federal bank or national bank, a federal credit union, a financial institution subject to exclusive regulation or supervision by a federal agency. So I think that answers my question.
Madam Chair, Representative Great. Berger, that's how we read it also, that it applies to state chartered banks but not federally chartered banks.
Okay, thank you. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Excuse me. Corey, I got a question for you. I'm a little confused. If you could clarify how the truth in lending law applies to state versus federal chartered banks and institutions. Does it apply to both?
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, yes, it does. Truth in Lending Act applies to state and federally chartered lenders.
Okay, then I have a follow-up.
Follow-up.
Then this law... Okay, so when people were talking about having two different stacks of paper to meet the different disclosure requirements, if you were a state-chartered institution, that's what they're talking about. You would have the truth in lending disclosures alongside whatever we're coming up with here.
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, that's correct. For the state-chartered loan subject to this bill, an additional state disclosure would be added to that stack.
Okay, other questions? Okay. Looks like you have answered everybody's questions, and thank you for your explanation. Members?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
You're welcome. Members, we're in a work session, and Representative Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3603.
Representative Buckley moves the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3603. Is there discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, is there objection to the amendment? Hearing none, amendment is adopted. Representative Buckley.
Madam Chair.
I'm sorry, did you have a comment before I gaveled that
amendment?
No. No.
Okay.
I'd like to be recognized, though.
After the gavel.
All right. I'll recognize you.
I'd like to make a motion.
Please state your motion.
Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 3603 as currently amended to the Committee on Ways and Means without recommendation. I note in the staff measure summary that there are significant hours added to this and a fee increase. DCBS will collect additional other fund exam fee revenue. Exams are billed at $75 an hour, and I think this bill belongs in Ways and Means.
Okay, we have a motion before us, which would be, I'm sorry, could you restate your motion?
That House Bill 3603, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means without recommendation.
Okay, Representative Berger has moved that House Bill 3603, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means without recommendation as to passage. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Okay.
Madam Chair, is it possible to hear from the department who's going to be administering this on this issue? I assume these additional staff hours will all be worked by Corey Streisinger.
Welcome back, Corey.
Thank you.
Would you like to shed some light? It looks like we do have a fiscal analysis in front of us that's been prepared, and please comment on it.
And incidentally, Madam Chair, I believe I forgot to identify myself for the record earlier. I apologize. I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And I haven't seen legislative staff analysis, but I can make reference to the fiscal analysis prepared by the department, if that would be helpful. As we look at this bill, we see that it calls for departmental activities in three different areas primarily. The first is rulemaking. The second is examination. And examination is the process by which we regularly visit the lenders that we license and regulate and review compliance with Oregon laws. And then the third area is enforcement to pursue violations. And so we took a look at each of those three areas, and we are dealing with four different categories of lenders here: banks, credit unions, mortgage lenders. That actually subdivides into mortgage brokers and mortgage bankers, and then consumer finance lenders. And those are all, each of those four sets are actually regulated under a separate section of Oregon laws, and we act slightly differently toward each of them. So in analyzing the rulemaking, generally speaking, we do rulemaking as part of our normal activity. We do see rulemaking in a number of areas here. In the definition of non-traditional and subprime loans, we're asked to address that through rulemaking, and we are also asked to develop the disclosure form through rulemaking, and our assumption in doing the fiscal analysis is that that would be absorbed as part of our normal rulemaking activity. It would take time, but we generally do have the ability to do a certain amount of rulemaking as part of our normal duties. Secondly, examinations, and we looked at each of those lending types. What we have been advised by the state-chartered banks and credit unions is that they do very little subprime and non-traditional lending, if any. This bill applies only to subprime and non-traditional mortgage lending. It does not apply to conventional lending. So we have, although we would look at that type of activity, we have assumed a fairly minimal change in examination activity with respect to banks and credit unions. With respect to mortgage lenders who do subprime and non-traditional lending, we have assumed some additional examination time, I believe an additional 5 minutes per loan file that we look at to check for compliance with this new law. Obviously, that's an estimate, and it may turn out to be more time-consuming. It may turn out to be less time-consuming, but we have assumed that for the mortgage lenders, that would be essentially absorbed as part of the normal examination cost, although it may mean that we can do slightly fewer exams. The major impact that we saw is in the consumer finance lenders, because right now our jurisdiction over consumer finance lending is limited to loans under $50,000. And so real estate lending, generally speaking, we don't examine the lending files for the types of loans that would be covered by this bill. So we would need to do additional exams, and we've estimated that in each of our exams for those lenders, we would review an additional 10 loan files. We do sampling, of course, like audits. And we have estimated the time commitment involved for each of those additional exams. And I believe when we did the math in terms of number of loan files, number of examinations, number of minutes, we came out up with a rough estimate of $30,000 associated with the additional exams for the consumer finance lenders. That's the specific dollar figure. Exams are, we charge by the hour. That is, we charge, the way our revenue structure works for mortgage lenders and for those consumer finance lenders is they pay an annual licensing fee, which covers the sort of general regulatory activity that we do. But then in addition, any of those lenders that we examine, they pay for the exam costs at an hourly rate. So if we do increased exam time, and this is, I believe, what Representative Berger was referring to, there will be additional revenues that will offset the cost associated with those exams. And as I say, our estimate, and it is simply an estimate, was roughly $30,000 for that specific part of our activity. Now, the third activity that I mentioned is enforcement. We have enforcement staff, and through Senate Bill 1064, which passed out of Ways and Means last night, we will be adding two additional enforcement staff to beef up our enforcement in the mortgage lending activity generally. Part of Senate Bill 1064 increases our enforcement over loan originators, but as we discussed in the fiscal impact of that bill, part of the justification for those two additional staff is not only to handle that activity, but to give us a more robust presence in enforcement for mortgage lending generally, because of the nature of the concerns that we're all familiar with. So we have assumed in our fiscal impact statement the passage of that bill and the increase in enforcement staff. And generally speaking, as with all of our enforcement activity, we prioritize. And so enforcement in this area would be prioritized along with the other types of mortgage lending enforcement that we do. So as I say, it's difficult to be exact any time that we're in this area, but that is how we analyze the fiscal impact of this bill.
Thank you very much for those comments, and those comments do seem to be reflected in the fiscal analysis that I'm looking at, too, so it does look like it's absorbable and minimal. And is there further discussion on the motion?
A question?
Yes, Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Corey, when we get a bad actor here and we prosecute, isn't that the Attorney General that does that?
Actually, Madam Chair, Representative Esquivel, we work collaboratively with the Attorney General, and in major cases, first of all, we do administrative enforcement, which is handled within our agency, and then in specific cases, we are also designated as special attorney generals, and then there are also criminal cases where we work directly with district attorneys. In fact, our agency has been actively engaged in several fairly well-publicized and successful prosecutions that you may have read about in the newspapers. Mr. Pritchett is one who I think received a fair amount of headlines recently, and there have been others. So we actually do prosecute cases in our department as well.
And there's no effect on that follow-up, no potential fiscal there?
Madam Chair, Representative Esquivel, we have not anticipated action by the Department of Justice in connection with this bill any more than is normal as part of our enforcement activity.
Thank you, Corey. Further discussion? Yes, Representative Berger.
Yeah, Madam Chair, we do have the fiscal analysis of proposed legislation from our fiscal analysts, and there are some language in here that gives me pause and leads to my motion. For instance, DCBS will collect additional other fund exam fee revenue as exams are billed out, and they anticipate minimal indeterminate general fund revenue. But if costs exceed additional revenue generated through examination fees, DCBS may need to increase fees.
Further, the bill also authorized Director of DCBS to sue violators in court. If this occurs, the DOJ would provide legal representation for these services. At this time, it is not known whether DCBS will incur increased legal expenditures. Given the uncertainty surrounding this bill, DCBS or DOJ may need to return to the Emergency Board to request additional other funds limitation to cover future costs associated with implementation of this bill. I am simply suggesting by my motion that there are uncertainties about the fiscal cost of this. I also would like to add that because this bill creates a very two-tiered system within the industry, I think that the state itself will be sued over that. It's very likely, in my opinion. And so I think there is a fiscal on this bill that we're sort of brushing over with. We think we can get it inside the agency budget. And I think that Ways and Means needs to look at this bill, and that's the substance of my motion.
Thank you. Thank you for those comments. And Representative Berger, I would just point out that you did not read the last sentence of the paragraph that you were reading, which says the department estimates that they will not need to raise fees until 2011. So clearly that issue has been contemplated and addressed. Any further discussion on the motion? Okay, the motion is to refer House Bill 3603 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee without recommendation as to passage. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Hunt?
No.
Representative Shields?
No.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Buckley?
No.
Chair Rosenbaum?
No. That motion fails. And we have adopted the Dash 3 amendment. I'll recognize Representative Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3603 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a rescission of the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Buckley has moved House Bill 3603 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded. On the motion, the chair will point out that the original bill, which has been replaced now by the Dash 3 amendment, did have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. We are requesting that to be rescinded, particularly in light of the discussion that we just had about the minimal fiscal impact of this bill. Is there discussion on the motion? Okay. I'm Representative Berger.
I probably should save it for a floor speech, Madam Chair, but there is no emergency here. The feds are going to act on this, and we would have a uniform system. We heard clear testimony that would work for all, but instead we are going ahead and taking part of the industry and putting them under one set of constraints and rules and the rest of the industry under another. That's not what we should be about in this session. I am very much opposed to this bill. And I thank you for your forbearance this evening.
Thank you, Representative Berger. It's always good to practice a floor speech.
Yes, it is.
And I will just comment that I think this is a very modest proposal. I wish that the federal government had stepped in a long, long time ago. I think that the housing crisis in this country and the collapse to a large extent of the lending market is having repercussions that are being felt nationally. I also wish that Oregon had had some stronger laws like other states did dealing with things like prepayment penalties. The reality is, though, that we are where we are, and we can only do what we can tonight to address what I think is a looming crisis here in Oregon. I would just suggest that if you were one of the people about, like the stories we heard from throughout several weeks here in this building, or this morning from the Portland detective of people who have been suffering some tragic consequences, that you would probably think it was an emergency, and you probably wouldn't want to see the next person fall victim to the same kinds of unfortunate circumstances that have befallen some Oregonians already, and as we have heard, lots of others still to come. So though I fully appreciate that this may not be the ultimate solution to everybody's problem, I do think it is something that we as a legislature can and should do, and that's why I'll be supporting the motion. And yes, Representative Esquivel.
Yes, first of all, I want to have everyone think about this. I remember reading an article in the Medford Mail Tribune that said subprime lending crisis. Then you got to reading the article and it said 1 in 510 homes in the United States due to this would be foreclosures. 1 in 1,100 in the state of Oregon and 1 in 1,400 in Jackson County. 1 in 500 is 0.002. 1 in 1,400 is 0.0007. 7/1000ths of 1%. That's an article right out of the Medford Mail Tribune. People don't stop to realize and do the math on these numbers that get thrown around on these articles that are very interesting. Some people make poor decisions. Doesn't matter what we do, they're going to make poor decisions. We have laws upon laws upon laws that govern people in this country. We have anti-meth laws. Do we have people that abuse meth? We have speeding laws. Do we have people that abuse speeding? We have real estate laws. Do we have bad realtors? Yeah. We have lending laws. Do we have some bad actors in the lending industry? Yeah. There's always going to be someone that's tapping the system. What we do here today is not going to have an effect on anyone at all because the die is cast on these people. And the subprime market is virtually gone. That's been very apparent here. All I can say about this bill is you can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. And that's what we have.
Further discussion, Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think actually Representative Esquivel's comments actually crystallized one thing for me because he referenced, we could pass lots of bills around meth, and we're studying on people using meth. And I think that's true, and yet I look back to the 2005 session when we actually did take on a very difficult issue. We had a bunch of folks from a different set of industries saying, don't do it, you're going to kill us. And they were saying, this isn't going to solve the problem, we're still going to have meth in Oregon. But if you look back at the action that most of us on this committee voted for in 2005, dramatic impact on shutting down meth by taking one very specific action. I will confess I'm very torn on this issue because I think we had a great and still have a great mortgage lending task force, legislators, industry, consumer advocates. They did great work in bringing forward two bills, one of which we passed, the other one we'll act on in the next few days as a House. I will say I'm distraught by kind of both ends of that spectrum that they got so locked into really positions of purity that it almost has become an all or nothing kind of approach. But that's why we make the big bucks, colleagues, to make those tough choices in the gray area in between. I think in terms of process issues, this is a very close call for me. I would have much preferred this be in the Consumer Affairs Committee. They build up far more expertise than any of us have. I would have preferred that there would have been recommendations in this area that came out of the Mortgage Lending Task Force. I would prefer that we actually do have an option for uniform coverage between state and federal chartered institutions. I would certainly like the certainty of when and how and if the Federal Reserve was going to act. We don't have that. And so I think we're left, frankly, on the process with a very close call. So then I look at the content, and as I look at this bill, which is not Senate Bill 465 and it's not Senate Bill 1090, it has just been severely narrowed to the point that, frankly, I wish this is where we'd started in November or December or January, because I think these two areas are the two that I've heard folks talk about all along, prepayment penalties and disclosure. Not getting into the very amorphous issues around how lenders can assess whether someone qualifies for a loan, but really focusing on two issues and two issues only. And recognizing that we do tend to lag the nation as a state in these economic issues. And we've clearly seen an increase in Oregon in foreclosures. It is true we continue to be, at least through the third quarter of last year, which are the latest numbers, still tend to be down there among other states, but the numbers are clearly increasing. And so, you know, with a close call in process, but with a much narrowed content, I was really, as I was reading a Christmas card letter I got from one of my constituents, rereading it earlier this afternoon, the whole content, you know, we send out holiday cards, and the content's talking about our families and our dogs and our kids and our jobs. The whole content of this, from one of my constituents, their whole Christmas card letter was about how their home had been foreclosed on over the course of last year. And it just colored, it's not like that took 12 months for that foreclosure, but it just colored their complete year and has just colored their complete life going forward. If there's any reasonable step we can take, and we have to, I mean, I think the choice for us is which side are we going to err on? Are we going to err on counting on the Federal Reserve to do the right thing, counting on the federal government to act, or are we going to err on trying to provide a little protection for consumers? I will err on the latter. Uncomfortably, but certainly.
Thank you for those comments. Yes, Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I made several comments this morning, so I won't go on at length, but I do appreciate the fact that we are taking a step and drawing a line. Out of deference to my colleague, Representative Gilliam, and also many of my constituents, I heard the phrase bad actor used so many times in this discussion. And I've asked for that to be kind of banned from our discussion, just because it's associating bad actors with anything in Oregon. I just don't want to have it happen. It is very true that things got out of control with this industry. I actually wish that we had been able to have a more rational discussion in 2007 concerning subprime mortgages, the intensity of the opposition to any kind of reasonable regulation at that point leads us to places where we are today. I take the testimony of the detective that came from Portland very seriously, with the number of people she sees struggling on a daily basis. And as with Representative Hunt, I would always err with the consumer. The point was made about fiscal education, and I absolutely fully agree with that point. We need to do more to make sure people understand what they're doing when they enter into situations. But if there's even one home in Jackson County that's being foreclosed, that's one home too many. And if there's a way we can avoid it by having reasonable limits on prepayment penalties, reasonable disclosures. In fact, as I mentioned this morning, I would over-disclose, and I think we need to over-disclose until we have people that understand fully the type of situations they're getting in. They can lose their house, and it is going to impact their family. It's going to impact their lives. I will always err on the side of the consumer. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Further discussion, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I guess I just have to weigh in here since we've pretty much all said. I might be rehashing something I've said before. We've had a work group. We've got a work group. Let's let it work. None of these recommendations in this bill came from this work group, and I feel like we're just pushing something through to make it look like we're doing something. And I said it on the first day we were talking about legislative concepts, and I think this is plain old too complex an issue to be dealing with in such a compressed time. And to do it right, I think we should wait till the 09 session. This is not going to help people, but it probably will mess up a lot of Oregon businesses.
Okay. Seeing no further discussion, please call the roll.
Representative Escobar?
No.
Representative Hunt?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
No.
Vice Chair Berger?
No.
Vice Chair Buckley?
Aye.
Chair Rosenbaum?
Aye. Motion carries. And we will ask Representative Holvey to carry this bill on the floor. I think he's had probably more practice than anyone else talking about the concepts of this bill. And members, I will close the work session on House Bill 3603, and remind the members that we are meeting at 8:30.
8:30.
Oh, we have half an hour, and we will be in this room, which is Hearing Room E. And we do have two additional bills that were just referred to as Senate bills. So please be on time, and hopefully we can complete.
I have to go.
Thanks a lot, and nothing further to come before us. We're adjourned.